Welcome, everyone. I am John Chung. Thank you for listening to my Totally Awesome Films podcast, where I will be discussing some of my favorite movies. For each episode, I pick a movie and discuss my experience watching the movie, and then I research some aspects of how the movie got made and talk about my opinion as to why I think this film is totally awesome. Continuing our James Bond retrospective, we come to the fifth film in the James Bond franchise. Last time, we took a slight diversion and discussed the non-canon 1967 Casino Royale. And in 1967, we have a return to the Ian Fleming books in You Only Live Twice. Sean Connery returns as James Bond for his pseudo-final film. He actually quit at the end of this, but he returned two movies later in Diamonds Are Forever. But we have a new director, a director named Lewis Gilbert, who would direct his first James Bond movie. He would go on to direct The Spy Who Loved Me as well as Moonraker. Now, this movie is a very important movie for pop culture enthusiasts. This movie has been parodied so much. In fact, this movie is pretty much the entire basis for the Austin Powers movies, as well as a couple episodes of The Simpsons. You really will not be able to get the humor of those episodes unless you've seen this movie. Now, again, I saw this movie as a teenager, and back then, I loved it. I mean, I thought I liked the cartoonishly campy aspects of the film. I thought it was entertaining as a teenager. And, you know, I gotta say that I still kind of like it now. Although there are some politically incorrect aspects, especially the sexism, that I found a little bit disturbing. Interestingly enough, I thought the portrayal of Japan was actually way ahead of its time. This movie will also kind of create a debate in the James Bond world that's kind of known as the real versus campy debate. A lot of people believe that a James Bond movie has to be campy, whereas many fans believe that it's the camp aspects of Bond that is actually ruining the franchise. So, I don't know which way you fall in that debate, but, you know, this movie is kind of the beginning of the ultra-camp direction that James Bond would often return to. Now, you know, this movie opens up with a U.S. and Soviet space race, and a third party, a third Asian party, which is heavily implied to be China, and they're launching a giant spaceship, and all of a sudden, this third party, this Chinese aircraft comes and literally swallows the U.S. and Soviet capsules, almost like a giant outer space mechanical whale. Now, we watch it now, and it seems incredibly unrealistic, but at that time, apparently it was very convincing. The special effects were believed to be very good and very terrifying. So, Bond travels to Asia. Specifically, he travels to Japan, where he meets MI6's agent there, a man named Tiger Tanaka, and he meets a Japanese agent named Aki, who was played by the Japanese actress Akiko Wakayabashi. The two have a romantic fling before she is assassinated, and this causes Bond to go undercover as a Japanese fisherman. At this point, he discovers a Spectre underground base in a hollowed-out volcano, and Bond and a band of government ninjas square off against Spectre, and in the end, the bad guys blow up in a huge explosion. Bond gets the girl, a gorgeous Japanese woman, just absolutely beautiful Japanese woman named Kissy Suzuki, played by the beautiful Miyahama. Bond saves the day and gets the girl. In an interesting bit of trivia, actually, Akiko Wakayabashi was actually originally cast to play Kissy Suzuki, and Miyahama was originally cast to play Aki. Now, this is really weird because I really thought the casting that they used in the movie was perfect. And the reason why is I really feel Miyahama is just much more beautiful than the actress Akiko Wakayabashi, who also is beautiful. But, you know, there is kind of a James Bond trope where the first love interest gets killed and the second, more stunning actress survives and becomes the true Bond girl of the movie. Considering that I thought Miyahama was just absolutely stunning, I thought this was appropriate. However, originally, the casting was reversed, and I thought this would have been very odd. I don't really know if this would have worked, but sure enough, Akiko Wakabayashi was cast to play Kisei Suzuki, and Miyahama was cast to play Aki, you know, the woman that gets killed. The reason why they switched was Aki actually has more speaking lines, and the actress Miyahama really did, her English wasn't that good, and she really had a hard time memorizing the English-speaking lines. And Akiko Wakabayashi spoke much better English and was able to memorize the lines easily. So the two got together and they decided that they would trade parts. And I think the final result works very well. Another snafu occurred in this movie when Bond creator Ian Fleming actually died before production of the film, and therefore he couldn't be involved in helping out in writing the screenplay. So the producers went to Ian Fleming's friend. Now, this is weird, folks. But the friend they went to was Roald Dahl. That's right, Roald Dahl, writer of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, as well as James and the Giant Peach. So this is really odd, but Roald Dahl, writer of Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, wrote the screenplay for this film. Yes, that's absolutely true. And the reason why is the two of them, you know, Ian Fleming and Roald Dahl, were actually really good friends. If you remember, Ian Fleming wrote another book called Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. And therefore, the two of them were kind of friends on the children's writer's circuit. And therefore, when the producers went to Roald Dahl, Dahl was more than happy to help out, you know, Ian Fleming's franchise and writing the next screenplay. Roald Dahl took what was generally known to be Fleming's worst book, which is You Only Live Twice, and kind of rewrote it and revamped it. The decision was made to go live in Japan, and this decision to go to Japan totally works for this film franchise. You know, the film franchise had become known for going to these exotic locales like the Bahamas and Jamaica, and taking it to something really exotic, especially for the time of Japan. I mean, it really works here. It sort of opens up the franchise, and now the movie feels much larger and much more international. It, you know, even more so if you consider this is the 1960s, when only less than 20 years ago, most mainstream Americans just thought of Japan as just a country they fought in World War II. They didn't really think of Japan as kind of how we think of Japan now, which is just a number one tourist attraction slash economic powerhouse. So, you know, this is really a neat time for the audiences to really witness Japan. And then when you see this movie, you really sense that the audience is being treated to a tour of Tokyo and of the Japanese countryside. What ended up being good for the James Bond franchise was not so good for Sean Connery. And when Sean Connery arrived in Japan, I mean, in Japan, James Bond had already become a huge phenomenon. And he was really hounded by intrusive Japanese fans and reporters. And Japan maybe has a little different attitude toward boundaries and what is considered appropriate, you know, cultural differences. And Connery was really really distressed by how much the Japanese paparazzi really hounded him. They broke into his hotel room, and at one point, apparently, the producers hired 30 Japanese security guards to prevent the paparazzi and the fans from harassing him. But unfortunately, apparently the guards even started taking photographs and harassing Sean Connery. The final straw was one of them took a photograph of Sean Connery while he was sitting on the toilet going to the bathroom. And that photograph was published in a Japanese newspaper. So, understandably, you can see why Sean Connery was upset, leading him to announce halfway through filming that he would quit the role of James Bond. When you watch this film, there are some really good elements that I'm really impressed by. You probably noticed that there's a rooftop fight scene, which I think, to this day, holds up as one of the most memorable, one of the most well-done and realistic and heart-pounding action sequences ever put on film. Even, you know, 40 years later, I think it still holds up as very innovative. You know, especially the moment at which the camera pans, it's really one long shot, and as the camera pans up, and you see Bond fighting off just dozens of people are ready to attack him. And again, even I'm watching this now in 2013, and I can recognize this as a brilliant, brilliant action sequence. That which I think rarely even been topped, even now. One of the things that I remember even now about this movie, when I watched this movie for the first time as a child, is the mini gyro helicopter scene. And you guys all thought this is pretty amazing. And again, this again was not a special effect. This little mini gyrocopter actually does exist. The helicopter is known as Little Nelly, and this is actually as equally innovative, entertaining, and not only does it hold up now, this again was a mind-blowing action sequence back when it aired in 1967. The producers, I'm not sure if it was Broccoli or Saltzman, but really got the idea to use this mini gyrocopter, Little Nelly, in the movie when one of them was listening to a radio, and they actually heard a radio interviewer by the helicopter's creator about this invention that that they made called the Little Nelly, and they immediately called this creator and purchased it for him. At the time, there really wasn't anyone else that can operate it, so the owner, the inventor of the Little Nelly, was actually the pilot they used when they were filming this movie. Now, since this movie, these Little Nelly helicopters have gone mainstream, and believe it or not, you can actually purchase one now for around $30,000. The structure of this movie is very similar in many ways to Dr. No, in that you have kind of an espionage, a reality-based espionage scene, and then halfway through the movie, Bond kind of goes through the looking glass and ends up in a Spectre base that is very fantastic and very colorful. And again, the result was dizzying then, and the same thing kind of happens here. About halfway through the movie, James Bond finds the island base, which in this movie is a hollowed out volcano. Now you can't get any more James Bond than this, right? The volcano, the roof of the volcano opens up and you have a secret underground military base. The cool thing is the producers actually really built this thing. I mean, they spent $1 million, which is, if you imagine, about $9 million in 2013 dollars, and they actually built a base with working monorails and a helicopter landing pad in this base. So I think that is really, really cool. And I think it does add a certain authenticity to this movie. This volcano underground layer, of course, is one of the most iconic images in cinema. Again, parodied numerous times, not to mention Austin Powers, The Simpsons, Get Smart, just numerous movies that have parodied this concept. Another brilliant bit of casting in this movie is the casting of Donald Pleasance as Ernst Strava Blofeld. So we meet Blofeld for the first time, and he is very, very sinister, very, very menacing, and very charismatic as the number one leader of Spectre. He himself has become kind of an iconic image, the bald man stroking the white cat in the gray outfit, which, you know, has been known as the Nehru jacket, made famous by the first Prime Minister of India, Nehru, would wear this kind of a gray jacket. And for our generation, it is clear that this man is the inspiration for Austin Powers' Dr. Evil. Right? I mean, it's a dead-on homage/parody. But he really is very sinister and very menacing. And we can see how this man, or a man like this, could be the maniacal leader of a huge terrorist organization. Interestingly, Donald Pleasance was not the first choice to play Nehru. The first choice was an actor named Jan Werick. And he was originally cast by producer Harry Saltzman to play Blofeld. But when they saw him in full makeup, the director Lewis Gilbert, as well as the other producer, Cubby Broccoli, really felt that Jan Werick did not work. They actually described him as a, quote, poor, benevolent Santa Claus, unquote. And sure enough, this actually is a pretty good description. You can go on Google and actually Google Jan, that's J-A-N, Werick, W-E-R-I-C-H, and Blofeld, and you'll see a picture. And sure enough, he looks just very kindly, like a kindly old grandpa, and not as menacing as Donald Pleasance. So the second choice was Donald Pleasance. And the actor had an idea that the character of Blofeld should have a deformity, you know, something that made him stand out. And they suggested something like a limp or a beard or a lame hand, something identifiable to be remembered. And they eventually settled on a huge scar on the face. And that's one of the most memorable things about a Blofeld, is that very disturbing scar. Unfortunately, apparently, you got to be careful what you ask for. Apparently, that prosthetic makeup for the scar was extremely uncomfortable. And Donald Pleasance was in a lot of discomfort on set because of the makeup that created that scar. So there was also reported tensions between Sean Connery and the producers, Cubby Broccoli and Harry Saltzman. At this point, Sean Connery was starting to feel that he was not being appreciated, especially financially, for creating this big franchise and turning Broccoli and Saltzman into multimillionaires while he was being paid very little money for the role of James Bond. He did say that he would return for the price of $1 million, which really, if you think about it, is pretty reasonable. They would eventually pay him that for Diamonds Are Forever. But at this point, they declined, and Sean Connery did decide that he'd had enough and decided to quit. We already know halfway through the movie he had announced his resignation as James Bond. After filming, he attended an interview by the media in Japan, and he came kind of wearing sweats and without his toupee, and just kind of in a comfortable button-down shirt. And the reporter asked him, "Hey, is this how James Bond dresses?" And Sean Connery said, "Look, I'm not James Bond. I'm Sean Connery, a man that likes to dress comfortably." So there we see that Connery wit. I personally like this film, and I personally like the campy aspects of the film. But you can easily see how this will sort of create the dichotomy of James Bond, where you have on one side, the campier James Bonds, which would include Goldfinger, but really this movie, Diamonds Are Forever, The Spy Who Loved Me, Moonraker, Octopussy, and I think a lot of the Pierce Brosnan Bond movies. On the other hand, you have some of the more realistic James Bond movies, Free Eyes Only, From Russia with Love, Under Majesty's Secret Service, and of course, the Timothy Dalton films, and this would kind of be a debate that kind of raged on among James Bond fans. Of course, for me personally, I kind of used to like a little more of the campier aspects until 2006 with Casino Royale and Daniel Craig really proved that the serious James Bond really does work. Although, if you think about it, Skyfall had sort of more campier elements that sort of worked as well, too. So again, the debate continues to rage on. This movie ended up doing extremely well in the theaters. The movie was made for a little over $10 million, so you got to think of this as kind of a $100 million budget film. And it went on to make $110 million internationally. So we're talking about, in today's dollars, almost $1 billion total take when you adjust for inflation. The next film we're going to talk about is perhaps one of the most controversial James Bond movies in film history, Under Majesty's Secret Service, where Sean Connery leaves the role and we get George Lazenby playing the role of James Bond, the first actor not to be Sean Connery. And of course, these are huge shoes to fill. And this movie really does divide fans. I think half the fans seem to really just absolutely love this film, and the other half of the fans just absolutely hate it. So go ahead and watch this movie. I'd really be interested in finding out which way you stand on Her Majesty's Secret Service. So let's return back next week for discussion of Honor Majesty's Secret Service. Thank you so much for listening, and I hope you had a good time.